Thank you very much. With apologies for those who've been slightly discombobulated by the slippage of our programme, I have to say I knew from the beginning of today that this was inevitably going to happen, but I'm sorry all the same that it has happened. But welcome to this session about St Anne's and the imagination, and we're delighted and honoured to have two distinguished contemporary writers here with us, one a fellow of St Anne's, the other an distinguished alumna and indeed honorary fellow. I'll just give you a few details of their writing, and then I will leave it to the writers themselves to talk to us. So first, Penelope. Penelope Lively was Penelope Lowe when she studied history at this college from 1951 to 1954. Her long and prolific career as a published writer began with the children's story Astercoat, published by Heinemann in 1970, the first of a rich collection of children's books, easily more than one per year by my calculation, right through to 1, 2, 3, Jump, which was published by Viking in 1998. She won the Carnegie Medal for The Ghost of Thomas Kemp and the Whitbread Award for A Stitch in Time, that's in this distinguished oeuvre of children's books. An equally impressive series of adult novels and short stories begins in 1977 with The Road to Lichfield and continues up to, and I very much hope beyond, How It All Began, which was published last year, 2011. Both The Road to Lichfield and According to Mark were shortlisted for the Booker Prize, which Penelope won with Moon Tiger, published in 1987. Awarded the OBE in 1989 and the CBE in 2002, an honorary fellow of St Anne's since 2006, she became our newest dame in this year's honours list for her services to literature. She has produced three works of non-fiction, including an introduction to landscape history, and has written extensively for national newspapers and journals and for radio and television. So that you don't, you've probably already heard too much of my voice already, but I'll get my part of it over, so I'll also give you some details about Patrick McGuinness. Patrick McGuinness studied and taught at Cambridge, York and Oxford before becoming a Fellow of St Anne's in 1998. He's Professor of French and Comparative Literature. In his academic persona, he has written on Maeterlinck, on Haussmann's, and on Symbolism, Decadence and the Fin de Siècle. He has edited the writings of unjustly neglected authors T.E. Hume, Marcel Schwab and Lynette Roberts. He invented and then neglected the Romanian poet Liviu Campanu, who was due to make an appearance in Patrick's novel The Last 100 Days, but, in the words of Patrick's own website, was dropped from the novel for slowing down its already glacial pace. Campanu's collection, City of Lost Walks, translated, in inverted commas, by Patrick McGuinness, is due to be published in 2013. Patrick's first published poetry collection, The Canals of Mars, appeared in 2004, followed in 2010 by Jilted City, also published by Carcanet, as was his acclaimed translation of Mallarmé's For Anatole's Tomb. Jilted City was a Poetry Book Society recommendation, and both collections have been published in various translations into other languages, but particularly perhaps worthy of mention is the Italian translations by Giorgia Sensi. Patrick's first novel, The Last 100 Days, was published last year by Welsh publisher Seren. It was shortlisted for the Costa Book Awards and longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. As to the latter, I'm presuming that, inspired by Penelope's example, Patrick will move in stately steps towards winning the thing. Now, as today's... just to refer briefly back to Penelope's speech at the Gordy dinner in 1985, she commented on the fact, which we've already heard referred to this afternoon, that St Anne's has produced a really remarkable number of writers over the years. The list is very impressive, and I'm not going to risk reciting it for fear of missing out somebody who is in this audience here today. I do, however, want to mention our newest author, Samantha Shannon-Jones, who I hope is here. Are you there, Samantha? Yes, here she is. Currently a second-year undergraduate reading English and the arts and literature representative of our JCR. Some of you may have seen from the newspapers that Samantha has very recently won a 7-book contract with Bloomsbury on the strength of her novel, The Bone Season. As we are here to celebrate St Anne's and the Imagination, I thought this was a good moment to congratulate Samantha and to wish her well in her exciting new venture. I hope that Samantha, along with others in this audience, may be able to join the conversation later on. Just to keep you up to date on our revised schedule, I've been told very firmly that we must be through by 6 o'clock, which I'm sure can be achieved. So, Penelope, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, David. Is this on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. And I have to say, it's an honour and a pleasure to be here today and talking to you. But I do have this strange feeling that I'm two people. That I'm me now, but there's this sort of ghost, this waif behind me, who is myself of however long ago it is. And even more so since I've got one or two contemporaries here, and although I see them as they are now, I also see them as their 20-year-old selves. So it is quite a strange feeling. And if that sort of ghost is looking over my shoulder, she would be completely amazed at what she is seeing of the college now, which is virtually, as far as I can see, a campus rather than a college. And as any of you of my sort of generation or the subsequent ones will remember, there was absolutely nothing very much in our day. I'm not going to talk about what it was like being of the generation of the 50s. A number of you will have been in the last session when Gillian Reynolds talked very eloquently of what the 50s generation was like. It's quite extraordinarily different from now. The university in general, one woman to 10 men, draconian rules for women, and so forth. But I would just say that my memory of St. Ann's very much is that it had the reputation then of being a slightly maverick college. It stuck its neck out. It used to take girls who had slightly iffy school reports and who looked as though they might be interesting. It was risk-taking, and we talked about that in the last session. And the senior common room was graced with Iris Murdoch, philosophy, and Peter A.D. in economics, neither of them exactly conventional figures. So it was a college with a sense of independence, and I think we were aware of that. Well, the student life of then seems in many ways a world away from student life now, but I've had informants over the last 3 years. I've had moles in the university by way of three grandchildren. So I've learned quite a lot, and what I've learned is that in many ways it isn't that different. They work hard and they play hard just as we did. I think they work harder, actually, than we did. There's an extraordinary sense in which, having once got here now, my goodness, they do have to work hard. But there's one eternal factor about being a student, one constant, and I think it's one that you may not realize at the time, and that is that it's a mind-altering experience. Well, now, I'd just like to say a word about how that worked for me. I read history, and I chose history rather than English because I felt that I read a lot of literature anyway, but that I didn't know any history. Now, of course, that's a view that would absolutely exasperate, and rightly, any member of an English faculty. And it's one that I soon revised when I saw what reading English really does mean. But I'm actually grateful for that, that ignorance, that naivety. It pointed me in the right direction. Reading history didn't make me into a novelist, but it's entirely decided the kind of novelist that I'd eventually become. I know that I write in the way that I do, partly because of those three formative years. Now, I wasn't an assiduous student, I didn't get a particularly good degree, but a cast of mind happened, it seems to me. I read and I think and I imagine in the way that I do because of what I read back then. Well, now, perhaps we may talk more about that later, this crucial mind-altering nature of the student experience. But before I finish, I just want to remember someone. David Smith has mentioned that St. Anne's has actually begotten quite a number of writers, but and this platform is about St. Anne's of the imagination. And I do feel that if anyone connected with the college has imagined, it's Ursula Fanthorpe, yes. U.A. Fanthorpe, who died not too long ago. One of the finest poets of the last century, for my money. Ursula was a contemporary of mine, although she was third year to my first year. And for that year, I lived under the same roof as her. We lived in the same hostel, 27 Banbury Road. And I can remember her very well as a sort of quiet, reserved presence. A bit older, I think, than the rest of us. I think she may even have been a slightly sort of mature student. Very kindly, we all respected her hugely. And today I read and I reread her. She was what's called a writer's writer, a poet's poet, and the memorial event for her at Wootton Bassett, where she lived, as I went to 2 or 3 years ago, was a kind of roll call of British poets of the last century and this, and I wish she was here today. Well, now, I'll just end. I think what we've decided to do is that both Patrick and I will read a short passage from our work, so very short. So I thought I'd read a little bit from Moon Tiger, which is a novel published now 25 years ago. And it feels to me as though somebody else wrote it. Well, now that is of course the case, because we all mutate through life, and writers mutate as much as anyone else, and you change, you shape-shift, you become not only a different person, but a different writer. We change and we develop. Well, the central character in Moon Tiger is Claudia Hampton. She's a historian, and she's dying, and she's looking back over her life. And she says, "I'm writing a history of the world." There are plenty who would point to it as a typical presumption to align my own life with the history of the world. Let them. I've always had my followers also. My readers know the story, of course. They know the general tendency. They know how it goes. I shall omit the narrative. What I shall do is flesh it out, give it life and colour, add the screams and the rhetoric. Oh, I shan't spare them a thing. The question is, shall it or shall it not be linear history? I've always thought a kaleidoscopic view might be an interesting heresy. Shake the tube and see what comes out. Chronology irritates me. There's no chronology inside my head. I'm composed of a myriad Claudias who spin and mix and part like sparks of sunlight on water. The pack of cards I carry around is forever shuffled and reshuffled. There's no sequence. Everything happens at once. The machines of the new technology, I understand, perform in much the same way. All knowledge is stored to be summoned up at the flick of a key. They sound, in theory, more efficient. Some of my keys don't work. Others demand passwords, codes, random unlocking sequences. But the collective past, curiously, provides these. It's public property, but it's also deeply private. We all look differently at it. My Victorians are not your Victorians. My 17th century is not yours. The voice of John Aubrey, of Darwin, of whoever you like, speaks in one tone to me, in another to you. The signals of my own past come from the received past. The lives of others slot into my own life. I, me, Claudia H.
Thank you very much, Penelope. We've heard quite a few people say, in the course of the session that came before this one, how different their lives were because they were here, and that isn't necessarily because they were here at St Anne's, because they came to Oxford University, because they had the experience they did have. Something I've been very interested in, particularly in your recent work, is clearly a fascination with contingency in our life. Two novels, the titles really give it away, Consequences and How It All Began. And in both cases, there's this sense of wondering how things might have been different. And I wondered if tying your writing in with your experience of St Anne's, whether you'd anything to add to those feelings people had expressed about how their lives might have been different.
Mm. I think, in a funny way, there is actually, yes. When I was in my second year here at St Anne's reading history, I read in the Times how a Professor Grimes was excavating the Temple of Mithras in the city of London. This is a Roman temple. And it was a major archaeological discovery and was causing considerable excitement. And there was a long piece in the Times about the excavation, about how he was using student volunteers. Well, I'd already found that I was interested in archaeology, although you didn't get much chance to look at anything like that when you were reading modern history. But so I wrote to him and said, could I possibly come and help on his dig? Well, he wrote back, and I don't have the letter, but it's very much in my head still. He wrote a charming letter saying that, unfortunately, he was now up to the eyes in student volunteers, and he simply couldn't use another one. But that if I, he was glad to hear of my interest in archaeology, and that if I wanted to pursue this, then I might think of doing a diploma in archaeology after my degree, in which case write to him, and he'd make some suggestions about where I might go. Well, I didn't. The road forked differently, the path went differently. I married young and had children young and ended up as a novelist. But I always feel that somewhere there's a sort of alter ego who has arthritic knees and has spent her life scrabbling away happily as an archaeologist. That's the road I might have taken.
Another feature that I pick up in returning to your writings is a sort of sense, I mean, this sounds like a sort of a flattering thing to say, but it's a sense of a lack of ego. You look at objects and experiences with a very clear eye. And I wonder, is this something that you think is just part of your personality, or is this something that you really work to achieve, a sense of almost of, not the absence of the narrator, but a sense of transparency in the things that you're writing about?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's quite a difficult one to answer, and I suppose I can only answer it by saying that it's part of the whole business of narrative technique, of fictional technique. I mean, you know, there's a kind of novel in which the authorial voice becomes involved. I mean, it may be the unreliable narrator kind of novel, which actually I haven't written very much. Or there's the one where the authorial voice is stepping back very much and is being a sort of commentator from outside. So I think I probably more favour that kind. Yes, I do feel usually that I'm standing back rather from my characters. They certainly aren't me. One of the things that nearly drove me mad about Moontiger was that in the years after it was published, because it had won the Booker and this sort of thing, I endlessly had to talk about it, and the one question I was always being asked is Claudia you? Mm-hmm. Well, all I could say was, if only. she's much more feisty than I am, much more sort of upfront and confrontational, and although perhaps a little bit her views on history are mine, nothing else about her was me at all. And in that same way, you know, you put bits of yourself into characters, but there's no sense in which they're ever completely you. I don't think I've answered that very satisfactorily. It was such an interesting question that I can't quite find my way to it.
That's a very good answer. Thank you.
I mean, I had a very peculiar childhood in that I didn't go to school at all until I came to this country for the first time at the age of 12 and was sent to boarding school. So it was a home education that was focused entirely upon reading. And also in this rather, you know, unusual backdrop of the Middle East during the Second World War. And of course, Egypt is it's time jumbled up. It's where everything happens at once. It's where Greek, Roman, Mamluk, everything is side by side. Well, I didn't understand this as a child, and I now think that nobody told me enough about it. We were living in, after all, rather interesting times in a rather interesting place, but we never did much about looking at this, except I went to the pyramids every Wednesday afternoon. That was a sort of normal thing to do. And saw all the things in the museum and so forth, but nobody explained to me anything very much. But certainly it had a dramatic effect, yes. There were two sort of cardinal moments that I remember about that. One is being taken to see what I now realise, I've researched this, must have been pre-dynastic tombs up the Nile somewhere in the Fayum in the desert, where an archaeologist were excavating very, very early pre-dynastic tombs, which were little sort of scraped circles in the sand in which lay the outline of a skeleton, a little body in a lying in a fetal position, and you could see the fan of the ribs and the hands. And I remember being shown these and thinking with complete amazement that was a person, and that was a person a long, long time ago, and being amazed by this. I think I was about 7 at the time. And the other sort of climactic one is being in London when I came to London for the first time. This was in 1945, and I was 12 by then. Being taken down to the city of London by a friend of my father's, where the blitzed remains of the city of London, which you'll know from the pictures, have been practically razed to the ground, had exposed the Roman bastions of the old city of London. And having explained to me that this was a segment of the Roman wall and these were the bastions. And I remember looking at these and thinking, Romans? But we had Romans in Egypt. How could there have been Romans up there? How could they have got up here? And realizing that there was some strange connection and therefore all sorts of mysteries that I simply didn't know about. I think that was probably the moment that fed me into eventually reading history at university.
Any more questions for Penelope from the audience? I wonder then if I might pass this microphone to Patrick. I don't know if you wanted to discuss some of the things Penelope's been talking about or whether you would rather just head off on your own.
I always like to head off on my own, but I think I can rejoin Penelope later when I want to maybe ask, say a couple of things about, I suppose, history and contingency. My experience of St. Anne's was that it was the first place to give me a really serious job, so I liked it, and I liked it for that, and I liked it for the students who applied, and I liked it for the students who came, and I liked, especially I think, the way in which it enabled me to run the life of an academic with the life of a creative writer. I don't like the word creative writing. I think most writing should aspire to be creative, but you know what I mean. And St. Anne's was very good at doing that, and I think that was partly because of the way we learned things and the way we thought about learning. Though I wasn't a student here, I've learned a lot of things from being here. I also had perhaps one of the most Beckettian moments in my whole teaching career here when I was talking to some very jaded finalists a few years ago, and they looked extremely uninterested in what I was saying. You could feel the apathy reverberating. And I said, rather sarcastically, in an attempt to wake them up, I said, I hope I'm not boring you. And one of them looked up and in utter innocence said, I don't know, I wasn't listening. So to me, St. Anne's is a place where students feel they can say that to their tutors. It's kind of the right degree of intelligent disrespect. While I was here, as David said, ran in parallel two, three different kinds of writing in ways that never really conflicted with each other. Teaching is stimulating, people are stimulating, students are stimulating. Even their ways of not stimulating you can at least provoke you into some kind of thought. And it's been a very creative place for me from that perspective. And as David mentioned earlier, I had a Romanian alter ego called Liviu Campanu, or Campanu. There's a bit of a dispute even among his readers about how to pronounce his name. But Campanu was in fact published. Some of his earliest poems were published in The Ship, so he too has a St. Anne's connection. So before I read a very small extract of my late communist Decline of the Ceausescu regime novel, I will quickly read you from a Ship issue from last year, actually. No? The 100th anniversary issue, where I translated some Campanu. And it's a poem called Leaving Do. And you see, the backstory of Campanu is that in this book, he always had lots of good lines, and everyone always invoked Campanu, and they said, well, that's Campanu who says, or this situation reminds me of something that turns up in one of Campanu's poems. And people were spending so much time quoting Campanu in the novel that they weren't actually doing the novelistic things you expect of characters, like living and acting and talking and experiencing world events. So Campanu had to go, but I rather liked him. So I decided that he had to be a real person in my poems, and I pretended to be his translator. And he's been quite successful in Britain, and more successful than his translator. In fact, when the book that came out last year appeared, people said, you know, the McGuinness, it's the usual stuff about Belgium and French literature and stuff, but this new Romanian guy he's found, now that's great. You know. So this is Campanu, one of the ship's distinguished poets. It's called Leaving Doom. His situation is that he's writing to his lover, who is the wife of a party apparatchik back in Bucharest, and Campanu is saying goodbye to her in his rather characteristic glum and muffledly erotic way. Leaving Doom. An ordinary day at work, except that it's your last. The pull of the new job, the new house. You've only been half here, living out of suitcases, sometimes with me, sometimes with the husband who does not know I borrowed you. Someone's head talks platitudes over warm Ukrainian fizz. They present you with the card we signed, using that biro on a string that's been hanging from the calendar since before either of us came. I'll tune out, become the centre of my own leaving do, because, well, that's what your leaving does. Later, from a dip of broken slats on the beer garden bench, I'll face the tram stop where you carefully missed your last ride home and watch something indistinct that's been hanging in the sky all day, longer than all day. This morning's taut blue air fattening into cloud, choking on a lemon-coloured haze. And this was a novel that I wrote very early in the morning or very late in the afternoons after teaching my students and on long train rides. Britain's a very good place, incidentally, to write if you're a commuter, because the length of the delays are absolutely terrific, you know. This wouldn't work in a proper European country. You wouldn't be able to get 380 pages out of commuting. This is at the very end of the novel, where they're watching the character, the nameless, faceless, characterless character, who is very loosely autobiographical, is watching the execution of the Ceausescus. And one of the good things about writing a novel where everyone knows the end is that you don't have to fiddle around with problems such as suspense, which is very good for me, being an academic, you know, wasn't my line. So this is the end of the Ceausescu regime, as witnessed by my narrator. By 5 o'clock, we were watching film of the trial on television. It's only the Ceausescus we see, sitting at a small table in a Targoviste bunker. They were defiant to the end and strangely tender in their small proprieties. It's always the small proprieties that stick in the mind. Perhaps it's because they seem to take death's measure and, for one brief moment, to square up to it. The way she buttons up her coat and juts out her chin decisively. The way he strokes her hand, smooths his hair, puffs out his chest. Is it my memory playing tricks, or does she, minutes before the end, wrap a scarf around his neck? You'll catch a cold. She's disorientated and in terror, but she musters a mad defiance. Asked how old she is, she replies, "You shouldn't ask a lady her age." This, no more than half an hour before they're shot. Every dictator's trial has one of these moments of unexpected dignity or fastidiousness when the bloodlust that's been stirred up begins to waver. What is he saying? There are subtitles, but it's just a desolate life and death patter. I am the president. I do not recognize this bandit court. I will answer to the people and to the people only. She says, "We made you. We looked after you. Is this how you repay us?" This is nonsense. The Romanian people love us and will not stand for this coup. Is it bravery? Or is it just fantasy outlasting its relationship with reality, like the last note of a symphony hanging in the silence that will swallow it up? It's all finished now. The camera pans across the corpses. Their faces are intact. The entry wounds are tidy. On the other side, the exiting bullets have ripped through their skulls and the backs of their heads flap open like hoods blown off in a gale. That's enough.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And I mean, before we open up the conversation again, I just wanted to ask you, I still remember you telling me of your slight astonishment at the huge success of the last 100 days. It's a very richly merited success. I've very much enjoyed your poetry before that point. They are quite different in the sense that it's very clear in the poetry that your scholarship and your close knowledge of all sorts of literary texts from various countries is hardwired into the poetry. This makes the poetry quite sort of dense and elusive, and it's not poetry for everybody. It's poetry that needs work. The last 100 days, I think, may have slightly surprised you by turning out to be a book that really is for everybody. It's despite what you say on your website, it has a very good narrative pace. I personally found it a totally gripping read, and it has clearly appealed to a very wide range of different people. I wondered whether you had a sense that you did want to do something that was slightly outside your academic bubble, though clearly it's a highly intelligent book. I mean, was this a new departure?
Well, my academic bubble is constantly being perforated by this thing called reality, which we're told exists somewhere outside the walls of college. I spent some time in the so-called real world when I was younger, and I spent some time in Romania, and it was pretty real, though not necessarily in the ways you'd have wanted. You know, it was a very grim, dark, difficult place, and it was quite formative, and it stayed in me for a very long time, and I was traumatized by it in a way. I dreamt about the place. When I was living there, I was watching large sections of the city of Bucharest being knocked down by Ceausescu, who was building his new socialist city. And you know, in his time, an area of Bucharest the size of Venice had been destroyed to make room for this hideous kind of Stalinist Lego that he was building. And for years I had a dream that I was back in Bucharest and I couldn't find my way according to the old maps because everything had gone. And so I had this dream every week or so. And when the book came out, I stopped having the dream. But there was something, I suppose, that I'd wanted to write a novel, I'd wanted to write fiction. I'd never tried before, I never thought I could do it. I wasn't sure I had anything to say, but there were lots of things I wanted to describe, sensations, places, smells and touches, and that's what made me do it. And I think if this book has appealed to anybody, it's because of that, I would have thought, rather than necessarily things like sort of incisive characters. The other thing we have to admit, I certainly have to admit, is that it was very lucky to appear in a year when there were all sorts of revolutions going on, and suddenly the topicality that the book for me never had. I thought, you know, who is going to want to read a book about a revolution that happened 20 odd years ago in a country people don't really think about, written by an academic who with a fondness for adjectives. But it was helped by this kind of domino clatter of regime collapses, and that helped it a lot, and it gave it a topicality it certainly was never destined to have. So in that sense, contingency and chance have helped me a lot. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask Penelope about the idea of history being a backdrop and what sort of role history might have in a novel, because I remember feeling really crowded out by history, by facts, and by other people's experiences in my book. And I would always see the term historical novel as being quite a terrifying one.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, your book is not that, but it is a, which I read and enjoyed very much, but it is a novel that's very close to public life. It's a novel that's entirely dependent on and directed by public life, which of course many novels are not. I mean, many novels exist almost in detachment, you know, it's almost as though there wasn't a historical backdrop. And I'm nervous of the term historical novel. I'm nervous of historical novels, period, really. I mean, I do think that they've got much better. There are people who are writing them very well now, whereas they used to be tarred with the the brush of Hare and Mary Rennell and people like that. They've entered a new world. I've never wanted to write one though. I think this may be to do with having with reading history in the way that I do. I just don't feel that I could attempt to achieve the mindset of another time and another place, and I certainly respect and admire people who try to do so, but I know it's something I not only couldn't do, but I don't even want to try to do. But at the same time, I do want, in a novel, I want there to be I want it to have a historical context, so that I would hope that any novel I've written could be sort of related to a time and a place, and that very much in the sense that my reading of fiction, I've always gone to fiction to find out about times and places. If I want to know about 19th century Russia, I read the Russian novelists, and if I want to know about a country, I'll try and find what contemporary novelists of that country there are in translation.
Yes, I think that would be the way I'd approach it. I suppose what interested me as well about approaching history that is still, well, a period that is still sufficiently contemporary for lots of people to remember it, is that if you spend too much time trying to convey the same facts that essentially everybody knows, you can get lost. So it's the angle you come at. And I've always liked novels which looked at big events, but from the side, you know, from somebody who's not involved. You know, if you wrote a novel from the point of view of Napoleon, it would involve invading countries and then retreating from them. Whereas if you do what Stendhal does, which is have somebody catching sight of Napoleon on a battlefield, but then going off to live the rest of his life normally, that for me is much more alive. Mm. And I wouldn't say that was a historical novel, though lots of people would argue that term about for it. Mm.
No, I agree. Yes, winding something in that way. I mean, I've never done it. I rather wish I had more stuck in, not a Napoleon, but put Macmillan in somewhere, walk on part or something. But I feel strongly about tethering novels to a time and a place, but in the way that you're suggesting, not in any kind of overt way. I'm just reading a novel at the moment. I won't say who it's by, which is set in the 50s, and it's just cluttered with the names of kinds of chocolate and that kind of thing, in order to give you the idea of the backdrop, so that you know where you are. You know, it's absolutely littered with references of one kind or another, and that doesn't do. It doesn't work.
No, I suppose people want things like that as signs of authenticity, but your eye just glides over them.
Mm. Mm.